Lecture 3, Kobowitz, Wednesday, June 11th, 1924. In agriculture, the cosmic and earthly forces I have spoken to you about have to work through the substances of the earth. Before we can start turning to various practical points, as we will do in the next days, we must spend some time today exploring in more detail the question of how these forces work. This will require that we investigate nature's activity in a very broad sense. One of the most important questions that can be asked with regard to agricultural production is, what is the significance of nitrogen? But it is just this question as to the essence of nitrogen's activity that has become extremely confused. We see, as it were, wherever nitrogen is active, only the last remnants of its influence, only its most superficial manifestations, and are unable to see the natural relationships in which it works. In fact, we cannot possibly see these relationships if we restrict ourselves to a specialized area of nature, but only if we look at nature in a broader sense and consider nitrogen's activity in the whole universe. As we will come to see, nitrogen as such may not even play the leading role in the life of plants. However, knowing what role it does play is one of the first things we need to know in order to understand the life of plants. The nitrogen at work in the natural world has four siblings, so to speak, whose effects we must also learn to recognize in order to understand nitrogen's functional significance within the household of nature. These four siblings are carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and sulfur. They are combined with nitrogen in plant and animal protein. But how they are combined remains a mystery for today's superficial science. To understand the full significance of protein, we cannot list merely hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon as its chief constituents. We must also include another substance whose activity is profoundly significant for protein, namely sulfur. Sulfur is the element in protein that plays the role of mediator between the physical in the world and the omnipresent spirit with its formative power. You might even say that anyone wanting to follow the trail the spirit leaves in the material world must follow the activity of sulfur. Its activity is not as apparent as that of the other elements, but that's exactly why it is so extremely important. The spirit working into the natural world follows the paths of sulfur. Sulfur is actually the carrier of the spirit. Its ancient name is related to the name phosphorus and derives from the fact that in ancient times people could see the radiating spirit within the radiating light of the sun. That is why they called substances like sulfur and phosphorus, which have to do with how light works into matter, the light bearers. Since sulfur's activity in the household of nature is so subtle, we would do better to look first at its four siblings, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen, and learn to understand what these substances mean within the life of the whole world. Chemists today actually know very little about these substances. They recognize their external appearances when they have them in the laboratory, but they know nothing at all about their inner significance for the world as a whole. What we understand about these substances through today's chemistry is actually no greater than the knowledge we have of people who we've passed on the street, people we photographed, perhaps, and whose external appearance we recall with the help of the photographs. What science does with these substances is not much more than take snapshots, and everything we learn about them through books and lecture courses is not much better. We need to get to know them in their essence, in their deeper nature. How all this relates to plants will soon become evident if we start with carbon. In recent times, carbon has fallen from its former aristocratic status to a very lowly one. And heaven knows how many other exalted beings have since taken the same path. Nowadays, all we see in carbon is coal for fuel and graphite for pencils. True, we still grant aristocratic status to one of carbon's manifestations, the diamond, but we don't get much opportunity to admire diamonds since we can't afford to buy them. Considering carbon's great significance in the universe, what we actually know about it is extremely little. But as recently as several hundred years ago, this black and dirty fellow was highly esteemed and given the very noble title of the Philosopher's Stone. There has been a lot of fruitless speculation about the Philosopher's Stone. But when the alchemists of old and such people talked about it, what they meant was carbon in all its different manifestations. They kept its identity so secret only because if they hadn't, anyone and everyone could have possessed the Philosopher's Stone. It was, in fact, carbon. And why was it carbon? We can answer that question with an idea that was current in olden times and which will also tell us something we need to know about carbon today. We must disregard carbon in the broken down form in which we know it when it has gone through various natural processes and emerged as anthracite or graphite. Instead, we must look at it in its activity in the realm of the living as it passes through human or animal bodies or builds up plant structures as only it can do. Then we realize that the amorphous stuff we imagined carbon to be is only the last remnant, the corpse, of what carbon actually is in nature's household. In fact, carbon is the carrier of all nature's formative processes. No matter what is being formed, be it the relatively short-lived form of a plant or the constantly changing figure of an animal, carbon is at work as the great sculptor. When it is fully active and internally mobile, it bears within itself not merely its own black substantiality, but also all the form-giving cosmic pictures, the great universal imaginations, which are the source of all forms in the natural world. A hidden sculptor is at work in carbon, and this hidden artist makes use of sulfur when it builds up the many different forms that have to be built up in nature. To look at carbon in nature in the right way, we must see how the spirit activity of the universe works as a sculptor, moistening its fingers with sulfur, so to speak, and how, with carbon's help, it builds up not only the more static forms of plants, but also the ever-changing human form. For we are humans rather than plants precisely because by excreting the carbon as carbon dioxide, we can immediately destroy the forms that arise in us. The carbon would make our body too stiff and rigid, too much like a palm tree, if it weren't for our respiration, which tears the carbon out of its rigidity, combines it with oxygen, and diverts it to the outside. Thus, we human beings can retain the flexibility of form we require. In plants, on the other hand, even in animals to a certain extent, carbon is bound to a static form. With regard to human beings, the old saying, "Blood is a very special fluid," is quite true, since the human ego manifests physically in our pulsating blood. But it would be still more accurate to say that the human spirit, what we know as I, moves through our blood along paths moistened by sulfur and laid down by the weaving and working, shaping and dissolving activity of carbon. And just as the human ego, the true human spirit, lives in carbon, so too does the universal ego, in the spirit of the universe, live via sulfur in the ever-forming and dissolving carbon. In earlier epochs of the Earth's evolution, it was carbon that was precipitated. Only later were the calcareous substances added, which human beings then used to create a solid support for themselves. In order for what lives in carbon to remain mobile, human beings and also the higher animals created an underlying solidity in their calcareous skeletons. That is how we raise our mobile carbon formations above the solid, purely mineral calcareous formations of the earth, which we also incorporate into ourselves in order to have solidity within us. In the lime of our bones, we have solid earth within us. You can conceive of this as follows. All living things have an underlying carbon framework, more or less solid, or more or less fluctuating, as the case may be. And as the spirit moves through the world, it moves along the lines of this framework. Let me just sketch this schematically so we can have something in front of us. Here is the framework that is built up in some way by the spirit with the help of sulfur. And there's a drawing. This carbon framework is either constantly changing and moving around. Excuse me. This carbon is either constantly changing and moving around within the very finely diluted sulfur, or it is more or less solidified and mixed with other constituents to form a solid structure, as it is in plants. Now you see, whenever we consider a human being, or for that matter, any other living being, we must realize that this living being is permeated by something etheric, which is the actual bearer of life. We have often talked about this. The carbon framework of a living being has to be permeated by this etheric principle, which either clings to the framework or moves around and fluctuates. But the etheric principle must extend just as far as the framework does. We can say something etheric must exist within the framework. Now, if this etheric principle remained on its own, it could not exist in our physical earthly world. It would constantly be slipping away as if it were nothing at all. Without a physical carrier, it would be unable to take hold of what it needs to take hold of in the physical world. It is characteristic of everything on earth that spiritual things must always have physical carriers. Materialists see only the physical carriers and forget about the spirit. And since the physical carrier is always the first thing we encounter, they are always right, but they don't take into account that spiritual things always need physical carriers. We can say that in the etheric, the lowest spiritual principle is at work. This etherically working principle permeates its physical carrier, helped again by sulfur's moisture, in order to guide into physical existence something that is not concerned with building up the framework, but rather with infusing it with unceasing life and movement. This physical element, which carries the life effects out of the ether with the help of sulfur, is oxygen. You can imagine what I have sketched here in blue as representing the physical aspect of oxygen, and within the oxygen, the surging, weaving, and vibrating of the etheric. With the assistance of sulfur, the etheric principle moves along the paths provided by oxygen. Seen in this light, our breathing process begins to make sense. Through our breathing, we take in oxygen. Modern materialists speak only of the oxygen that is present in chemists' flasks when water is broken down by electrolysis. However, everywhere within this oxygen, the lowest supersensible principle, the etheric principle, is present, unless it has been killed off, as indeed it must be in the air that we have around us. In the air we breathe, the life of the oxygen is killed off so that we do not faint because of the living oxygen. That is what happens if something with a greater degree of vitality enters into us. We become unconscious. Even an ordinary case of rampant growth, if it occurs in us in a place where it shouldn't, is enough to make us faint or worse. If we were surrounded by air with living oxygen in it, we would all go around in a stupor. The oxygen around us has to be killed off. Nevertheless, right from its inception, it is the carrier of life, of the etheric. And as soon as it escapes from the tasks allotted to it while it is outwardly surrounding our senses, it immediately reverts to being the carrier of life. As soon as it gets inside us through our breathing, it is allowed to become alive again and promptly does so. The oxygen circulating inside us is not the same as the oxygen that surrounds us on the outside. Inside us, oxygen is alive, and it also becomes alive as soon as it leaves the atmosphere to enter the soil. Although it's less alive there than it is inside human beings and animals, it is alive nonetheless. The oxygen underground is simply not the same as the oxygen above ground. Naturally, it's hard to come to a common understanding on this subject with physicists and chemists. Because of the methods they employ, the oxygen, they know, always has to have been removed from the ground, so all they ever see is dead oxygen. That is the way it has to be. But that is the case with any science that chooses to take into account only physical things. It only understands corpses. In reality, however, oxygen is the carrier of the living ether. And this living ether uses sulfur to gain control over oxygen. I have just juxtaposed two things. One is the carbon framework, in which the activity of the highest spiritual principle accessible to us on earth is revealed, either as the human ego or as the universal spirit at work in the plants. The other is the living ether-bearing oxygen, which appears within the human being during the process of respiration. These two things need to come together. The oxygen needs to be able to proceed along the paths of the framework. It must be able to go wherever any sort of line has been traced by carbon, by the spirit of carbon. Everywhere in nature, the etheric oxygen principle has to be able to find its way to the spiritual carbon principle. How does it do that? What is the mediator in this process? The mediator is none other than nitrogen. Nitrogen guides life into the form or structure embodied in carbon. Wherever nitrogen appears, its role is to mediate between life and the spirit, which temporarily assumes form in carbon. Everywhere in the animal and plant kingdoms, and also in the interior of the earth, the bridge between oxygen and carbon is provided by nitrogen. The kind of spirituality active in nitrogen, once again with the help of sulfur, is what we call astrality. It is the same as the astral spirituality in the human astral body, or the astral spirituality that surrounds the earth and works into the life of plants and animals and so on. Spiritually speaking, astrality stands between oxygen and carbon. But in order to become physically effective, it makes use of nitrogen. Wherever nitrogen is, astrality reaches too. The etheric life principle would float around like a cloud, would not take the carbon framework into account at all if the nitrogen did not have such a strong attraction to the carbon framework. Nitrogen drags the oxygen, that is, the astrality in nitrogen drags the etheric in oxygen along to wherever lines and pathways have been set out in the carbon. Nitrogen is the great transporter who constantly brings life toward the spirit. That is why nitrogen is essential to the human soul, which, as you know, is the mediator between mere life and the spirit. This nitrogen is really something wonderful. If we trace its paths in the human organism, we find it forms a complete human being, a kind of nitrogen person. If we could separate it out, it would make the most beautiful ghost you could imagine, because it imitates a person's solid framework so exactly. On the other hand, immediately afterwards, it flows right back into the life element. This gives you an insight into the breathing process. Through the breathing process, the human being takes in oxygen, that is, etheric life. Then the internal nitrogen comes along and drags the oxygen to wherever there is carbon, something formed that is also weaving and changing. It carries the oxygen to the carbon so that the oxygen can grab a hold of the carbon and expel it. The transformation of oxygen into carbon dioxide, the breathing out of carbon dioxide, is mediated by nitrogen. We are surrounded by nitrogen on all sides. Only a small percentage of the air around us consists of oxygen, the carrier of life. Most of it consists of nitrogen, the carrier of astral spirituality. The oxygen in our surroundings is of tremendous importance for us by day and also by night, but we often have relatively little respect for atmospheric nitrogen. We don't think we need it. Nitrogen, however, is precisely the thing that has a spiritual relationship to us. You could try the following experiment. Put someone in an airtight space and take away a bit of the nitrogen in the air so that the air surrounding the person is slightly poorer in nitrogen than usual. If the experiment were carried out carefully, I'm sure you would find that the nitrogen immediately replaces itself, not from outside, but from within. The person would have to give off some nitrogen in order to bring the percentage of nitrogen in the surrounding air up to the accustomed level. As human beings, we depend on being able to bring about the right relationship between our whole inner being and the surrounding nitrogen. We can't tolerate a decrease in the nitrogen outside of us. Of course, since we do not need nitrogen for breathing, the reduced amount would still be adequate. But for the spiritual relationship that exists, only the usual amount is sufficient. So you see how strongly nitrogen plays into the spiritual. And so you can imagine how important nitrogen must be for the life of plants. It is true that the plant, as it stands there in the ground, has only a physical and an etheric body. It does not contain an astral body as the animal does. Nevertheless, the astrality must outwardly surround the plant on all sides. The plant would not bloom if the astrality did not touch it from outside. Plants do not internalize astrality the way animals and human beings do, but they do need to be touched by it from outside. Astrality is everywhere, and nitrogen, the carrier of astrality, is also everywhere. It floats in the air as a corpse, but the moment it enters the soil, it becomes alive again, just as oxygen does. And paradoxical as this may seem to materialistic minds, the nitrogen in the soil not only becomes alive, it also becomes sensitive. This needs to be taken into account, especially in agriculture. Nitrogen really becomes the carrier of a mysterious kind of sensitivity that is poured out over the whole life of the earth. It is nitrogen that senses whether the right amount of water is present in a given area. It reacts sympathetically when the right amount of water is present and antipathetically when there is not enough water. It also reacts sympathetically when the right plants for a particular soil are there, and so on. In short, nitrogen pours out over everything a kind of sensitive life. Ordinarily, we are not aware of any of what I told you yesterday and earlier about the influences of the planets, Saturn, Sun, Moon, and so forth, on the form and life of plants. We simply don't know about it. But the nitrogen that is everywhere knows all about it. It knows what comes from the stars and takes effect in the life of the plants and the life of the earth. Here, as well as in our nerve sense system, nitrogen is truly the mediator of sensitivity, the carrier of sensation. You can get a glimpse into the most subtle workings of nature if you look at nitrogen as it constantly moves about like fluctuating sensations. And we will find that the way we handle nitrogen is something of tremendous importance for plants. We will go into this further, of course, but first there is one other thing we need to look at. We have seen now how there is an active interplay between what comes from the spirit and takes on form in the carbon framework and what works out from the astrality in the nitrogen, which permeates the framework with life and makes it sensitive. And we also have seen how life is active there within the oxygen. In the earthly physical world, all these things work together by virtue of their being permeated by something further, something which establishes a connection between this world and the widths of the universe. Our earthly existence would not be possible if the earth simply wandered through the universe as a solid body separate from the rest of the cosmos. If the earth did that, it would be like a person who lived on a farm but who wanted to keep what's growing in the fields separate from himself or herself. That is not very sensible. There are things growing out there in the fields which will soon be in the stomachs of this worthy company, and which will then find their way back to the fields in one way or another. As human beings, we cannot possibly keep ourselves apart from this, since we are connected with our environment and ultimately belong to it. The things in the surroundings belong to the human being just as my little finger belongs to me. A constant exchange of substance must take place. And the same thing must happen between the earth with all its creatures and the whole universe. Everything that lives on the earth and assumes a physical form must be able to be led back into the universe in order to undergo a kind of cleansing and purification. This is the situation. First, we have the carbon framework that I sketched in green. Then the etheric oxygen principle in blue. And then proceeding from the oxygen, we have yellow with the astrality that nitrogen carries to the different lines. The astrality that builds the bridge between what is carbon-like and what is oxygen-like. I could indicate everywhere how nitrogen pulls what is represented by the blue lines over into the green lines. But everything that assumes an organized and detailed form in living beings must also be able to disappear again. It is not the spirit that disappears, but rather what the spirit has built into the carbon and for which it has absorbed the life from the oxygen. All this must be able to disappear again, and it must not only vanish on Earth, it must be able to vanish into the universe. This is brought about by hydrogen, a substance that's as closely related as possible to both the physical and the spiritual. We must recognize that in hydrogen, despite being itself the finest physical element, the physical is completely shattered, and with the help of sulfur, flows out into the universe and loses all distinguishability. We could say that in organized structures, the spirit has become physical. That there, in the body, it lives, astrally, as the image of itself as spirit, as ego. It leads a physical existence there, as spirit, transformed into physicality. After a while, however, it no longer feels comfortable there. It wants to dissolve itself. Then, as it again moistens itself with sulfur, it needs to find a substance in which it can give up all structure and specificity and set out into the indeterminate chaos of the universe. And this substance, so close to spirituality on the one hand and to physicality on the other, is hydrogen. Hydrogen leads every kind of formed, enlivened astrality back into the expanse of the universe, to a state where it can then once more be taken up from the universe, as I have described. It is hydrogen that dissolves and disperses everything. So here we have these five elements: sulfur, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, which represent what's working and weaving in everything that is alive, and also in everything that temporarily appears dead. All these elements are inwardly related to a very specifically differentiated spirituality. They are quite different than the elements modern chemistry talks about. Modern chemistry talks only about the corpses of the substances, not about the real substances. We have to get to know their living, sensitive aspect. And because hydrogen is the least dense and has the smallest atomic weight, hydrogen is actually the least spiritual of them all. At this point, I need to interject something so that you can see that such things are not just thought up out of the blue. Let's ask ourselves what we are actually doing when we meditate. In the Orient, people used to do it in a particular way. We in the West, in Europe, do it differently. Our kind of meditation is only indirectly dependent on the breathing process. We live in the rhythm of concentration and meditation. Nevertheless, what we do in devoting ourselves to these soul exercises still has a bodily counterpart, even though it is very delicate and subtle. In a very subtle way, the regular pace of our breathing, which is so closely tied to human life, is always slightly changed during meditation. While meditating, we retain somewhat more carbon dioxide than we do in a state of normal waking consciousness. A little extra carbon dioxide always remains behind in us. Usually we are eager to thrust the full force of the carbon dioxide out into our surroundings. But in this case, we hold some back. We don't thrust the full force of the carbon dioxide out there into the environment that is filled with nitrogen. We hold some back. You see, if you bump your head against something hard, a table for instance, you will only be aware of your own pain. If, however, you rub against it more gently, you will become aware of the surface of the table, and so on. It is the same when you meditate. You gradually grow into an experience of the nitrogen that surrounds you. That is the real process involved in meditation. Everything becomes known, including everything that lives in nitrogen. And this nitrogen is a very smart fellow who can teach you about what Mercury and Venus and the rest of them are doing, because it knows these things and is sensitive to them. Activities like meditation are based on very real processes. And in fact, it is at this point that the spirit in our inner activity begins to acquire a certain relationship to farming. This interaction of our soul and spirit with everything that is around us is what has always particularly aroused the interest of our dear friend Stegmann. It is not a bad thing, you know, when a farmer can meditate and thus become ever more receptive to the revelations of nitrogen. Our agricultural practices gradually change once we become receptive to what nitrogen can reveal. Suddenly, we know all kinds of things. They are simply there. Suddenly, we know all about the mysteries at work on the land and around the farm. I cannot repeat what I have already said here in the previous lecture, but perhaps I can characterize it again in a certain way. Take a simple farmer, someone an educated person would not consider educated. The educated person may say the farmer is stupid, but in fact that is not true, for the simple reason that the farmer is actually a mediator. The educated person may say the farmer is stupid, but in fact that is not true, for the simple reason that the farmer is actually a meditator. He meditates on many, many things during the winter nights. And indeed, he arrives at a way of acquiring spiritual knowledge. He is only not able to express it. It just happens that it is suddenly there. As he is walking through the fields, it's suddenly there. He knows something. And afterwards, he tries it out. I lived among farmers when I was young, and I saw this happen over and over again. It really does happen. These are the kinds of things that have to be linked onto. Mere intellectuality is not enough. It does not get us deep enough. Nature's life and flow are so fine and subtle that in the end they slip right through the coarse mesh of our rational concepts. That's the mistake science has made in recent times. It tries to use coarse conceptual nets to catch things that are actually much too fine for them. So all of these elements, sulfur, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and hydrogen, are combined in protein. And now we'll be able to understand the process of seed formation more exactly than before. Wherever carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen are present, in leaf, flower, calyx, or root, there they are always bound to other substances in some form. They are not independent of these other substances. Only in two ways is it possible for them to become independent. Either when hydrogen carries them out into the expanse of the universe, taking away all their specific characteristics and letting them dissolve into a general chaos, or when hydrogen drives them into the seed-forming process and emancipates them there so that they become receptive to the influence of the cosmos. Chaos is present in the formation of the tiny seed, as well as way out there in the periphery. And when the chaos in the seed interacts with the chaos in the periphery, that is when new life comes about. Let's take a look now at how these so-called elements work in nature. They're called elements, but actually they are carriers of spirit. The behavior of oxygen and nitrogen within the human being, for instance, is actually relatively straightforward. The characteristics of oxygen and nitrogen are indeed present there. We just don't have access to them with ordinary science. because they are seemingly hidden within nature. Carbon and hydrogen, however, cannot be so well behaved. Let's take a look at carbon. When the carbon activity leaves the plant kingdom and enters the animal or human kingdom, it has to become mobile, as I have already indicated. There, in order to present a solid form, it needs to be supported by a more deep-seated framework. And this framework consists not only of our calcareous skeleton, but also of the siliceous element that we always carry within us. In humans and also in animals, the formative power of carbon is thus disguised to a certain extent because it uses the formative power of lime and silica as a kind of trellis. Lime supplies the earthly formative force, and silica is the cosmic formative force. In human beings and in animals, carbon is not the sole determining factor. It builds on the formative activities of lime and silica. Lime and silica, however, are also fundamental for the growth of plants. And now we must develop an understanding of what carbon brings about in the human processes of digestion, respiration, and circulation in relation to the skeletal structure and the siliceous structure. We need to develop an insight into what is happening in there, into what we would see if we could creep inside and let the human circulatory process show us how carbon's formative activity radiates out into the calcareous and siliceous elements. This is the perspective we must take when we look out over a field that is covered with plants and has lime and silica beneath it. We can't look inside a human being, but when it comes to the land, we must be able to recognize how oxygen is caught up by nitrogen and carried down into the carbon, that is, carbon, insofar as it is supported by lime and silica. We can also say that the oxygen only passes through the carbon. The oxygen around us must enter the earth, where it will become enlivened. With the help of nitrogen, it must penetrate into the depths of the earth, where it can then conform to the lime and be supported by the silica. If we have any sensitivity to these things, we can observe this process wonderfully in the papilionacea, in the legumes, in all those plants known in agriculture as nitrogen collectors. These plants are indeed dependent on drawing in nitrogen in order to pass it on to what is below them. When we look at them, we can see that something down there in the earth needs the nitrogen, just as human lungs need oxygen. And this is the lime in the ground. It is dependent on a kind of nitrogen inhalation, just as the human lungs are dependent on inhaling oxygen. And these plants, the legumes, represent something similar to what takes place on the epithelial cells of our lungs during inhalation. By and large, the legumes are the only plants of this kind. All the others are more closely related to the process of exhalation. Viewed in this way, the whole organism of the plant kingdom falls into two parts. Wherever we encounter legumes, we are seeing organs of respiration for the most part. And wherever we meet other plants, we are seeing organs that breathe in a much more hidden way and actually have other functions to perform. Our task then is to learn to see plants in such a way that each species place within the overall organism of the plant world becomes apparent, just as within the human organism, each human organ has its place. Once we have learned to see the individual plants as parts of a single whole, we will discover the great significance of the legumes. Of course, we know these things already, but it is important to understand them on this spiritual basis, because otherwise the danger is great that in the near future, As even more of our traditions are lost, we will set off in the wrong direction when we put new things into practice. You can see how the legumes actually function. It is typical of all of them that the fruit-forming tendency, which in other plants takes place farther up, is held back in the leafy region of the plant. These plants want to fruit even before they come into flower. You find this tendency in all the legumes, and it comes from the fact that these plants tend to keep what lives in nitrogen very close to the ground. In fact, they carry it into the ground, while the other plants develop it higher up. You can see how the legumes tend to color their leaves somewhat darker green than other plants. You can also notice that the actual fruits of these plants are somewhat stunted, as it were, and that their seeds lose their viability quite quickly. These plants, in fact, are organized in such a way as to bring to expression what the plant world receives from the winter, not from the summer. Therefore, it could be said, in these plants, there is always the tendency to wait for winter. They would actually like to wait for winter with what they develop. Their growth slows down when they find enough of what they really need, enough nitrogen in the air, which in their own fashion they are able to carry downward. That is an example of how we can look into the very life of what goes on in and above the soil. Then, if you also include the fact that lime has a remarkable relationship to the world of human desires, you will see how organic and alive everything becomes. In the form of calcium, a pure element, lime does not rest for a minute. It longs to be satiated, to combine with oxygen and become quicklime. But even then, it's not content. It still has all kinds of cravings. It wants to combine with any kind of metallic acid, even with bitumen, which is not even mineral anymore. It wants to draw everything into itself. Down in the soil, it manifests a real instinctive craving. People who are sensitive to these things will notice the difference between lime and other substances. Lime sucks at us, pulls us out. You get the distinct impression that something of the nature of desire is always present in conjunction with anything related to lime. Lime even draws the vegetative realm into itself because everything it desires is there in the plants. This has to be wrested away from it again and again. And how is this done? By means of something so thoroughly noble that it no longer desires anything. This noble substance, self-content and wishing for nothing more, is silica. Silica has come to rest in itself. And people are mistaken if they think silica is to be found only in the form of a solid mineral. Silica is actually present everywhere in homeopathic amounts. Silica is self-contained and undemanding. Lime is full of demands. But silica, like our sense organs, which do not perceive themselves, but only what is outside of them, silica no longer claims anything at all for itself. In earthly existence, silica is generalized outer perception. Lime is generalized outer desire. And clay mediates between them. Clay is closer to silica, but still mediates toward lime. We need to come to understand this so that we can achieve a kind of sensitive knowing. We should be able to experience lime as a creature of many desires, who wants to grab and take possession of everything, and silica as a noble aristocrat who carries everything wrested from the clutches of lime into the atmosphere and there gives shape to the plants. Silica lives either as if in a castle, as in the horsetail plant, or spread out over everything, sometimes in very homeopathic amounts. It is responsible for wresting away from the lime what must be wrested away. Here again, we are confronted with extremely subtle processes in nature. Carbon serves as the actual form giver of all plants, the shaper of their framework. But in the course of the Earth's evolution, this task has been made difficult for carbon. It could easily shape the plants if it only had water beneath it. But now the lime is down there and interferes. Therefore, in order to go on shaping the plants, carbon now allies itself with silica and then also with clay, because the resistance of the lime must be overcome. So what is it like for a plant to be involved in all of this? From below, the lime is reaching out to grab it. From above, the silica is trying to make it as thin and fine and fibrous as the aquatic plants. And in the midst is carbon, the real shaper of plant forms, keeping everything in order. And just as our own astral body brings about order between our ego and our etheric body, so does the astrality of nitrogen work there too. We must learn to understand what the nitrogen is accomplishing in among the lime, the clay, and the silica, in the middle of everything, that lime is trying to pull downward and silica is trying to radiate upward. This leads to the question of how to bring nitrogen into the plant world in the right way. We will take up this question tomorrow and thereby find the transition to the various forms of manuring. Thank you.